but I do think it's something that can be demonstrated. The court. If there are persons who meet the plaintiff's proposed class definitions who would not have standing, how could this court certify the class? Mr. Beck. Well, I think, again, I think that the definitions as we've set them forth in our complaint describe people who do have standing for the reasons discussed. That said, and again, this is why I think in some ways these issues merit a full class certification process, and discovery, and briefing, and so forth, as opposed to an alternative relief sought in a Rule 12 motion. But that aside, I think that the rule, Rule 23 specifically, is flexible enough for courts to change class definitions, certify subclasses, and so forth. So, I think it's... I don't think it would be the first time that a class, you know, if that were to happen, if that determination were made, I don't think it would be the first time that a court had determined that perhaps a class was overbroad or whatnot and needed to be refined. But again, I think those determinations are best made in the course of a Rule 23 motion for class certification. The court. Is it possible to narrow the class definitions in such a way that class members are readily ascertainable by objective criteria, while persons who do not have standing are excluded? Mr. Beck. Well, again, I don't think I'm... I would concede the point that, as defined in the context of our allegations and claims, that anybody, that any of these plaintiffs don't have standing, or any of the people who would be compassed within the class definitions don't have standing. That said, if it's just a matter that... of people. I mean, there are mechanisms by which people can opt out of class actions, and class definitions can also be revised throughout the course of a litigation, and frequently are. So it seems to me that that could be a possibility as well. But again, I don't think that there's anything about this particular class action that makes it any less susceptible to being managed by the flexible tools that are available under Rule 23, and at the court's disposal. And again, just because it happens to deal with politics, as opposed to a securities class action or something that's more commonly seen in lawsuits. The court. Given the nature of plaintiffs' claims, will individualized issues predominate over common issues? Mr. Beck. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that would be the case, Your Honor. Again, and I think this gets back to the point that the predominant rung here is the defendants acting behind the scenes to rig a primary process and not disclosing that to the public, and in fact taking actions to conceal that from the public. So because it's more of an issue of what was concealed as opposed to what was specifically stated, to me, that has the badge of a uniform omissions case. And my understanding of the law in this district and the 11th Circuit is that cases, even fraud cases, can be certified when a pattern of uniform omissions is established. And that analysis, I would think, would apply to the fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims that we've asserted. The court. What law will the court be applying with respect to counts 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6? Mr. Beck, let me confer with counsel. The court. Go right ahead. Take your time. Take your time. Discussion had off the record between counsel. The court. Take your time. Discussion had off the record between counsel. Mr. Beck. My co-counsel wanted me to correct something that I stated to the court earlier. The court. That's all right. Go right ahead. Mr. Beck. In regards to the residence of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The court. Citizenship. Mr. Beck, yes, the citizenship. My impression is that we had... That was the only paragraph that we had referenced her. But my counsels alerted me to the fact that in paragraph 1, we specifically state that Deborah Wasserman Schultz resides in and is as Congresswoman representing portions of this district, meaning the Southern District of Florida. So I think that is probably sufficient to establish her as a citizen of Florida. But to get to the question posed by the court just now, which is what law should the court apply to those specified counts? You know, our brief assumed Florida law or D.C. law. Again, I don't know that the record is well developed enough to make a choice of law now, so certainly I don't think it was fully briefed in the papers. And my understanding is that in the course of a class action, oftentimes subclasses are created, which correspond to the various laws invoked specifically to the various plaintiffs based on their citizenship, if in fact that's a factor that determines the choice of law analysis. And I'm not sure, again, that that issue is really before the court now. We cited, I think, one case in our brief which suggested that courts ought to await a more fully developed factual record before engaging in those determinations. So, I guess at this stage, we would rest on the position in our briefs to assume that Florida or D.C. law applies to those counts, but without waiving any argument that other laws may not apply to those class members as well. The court. If my count is accurate, taking it, that count coming from the first amended complaint, assuming arguendo, that the court must apply 46 different jurisdictions laws to this case, would a class action be manageable? Mr. Beck. I think there are cases that address that issue in the class certification analysis, and oftentimes it depends on the whether or not there are material differences in the various laws being applied, such that manageability becomes a problem. I guess without delving into the what may be the material differences for those counts, and I don't know that there are any, but again, that's a, you know, I think that's an issue that comes up on Rule 23, in the context of a Rule 23 motion. And I think, you know, in making that determination, the court is probably best, would benefit most from having full briefing and discovery on those specific issues as they relate to class certification. The court. And, again, assuming arguendo that the court must apply 46 different jurisdictions' laws to this case, are there questions of law common to all members of each class? Mr. Beck. Yes, I do think that regardless of whether how many states' laws would ultimately apply, the issues of law, I mean, it would surprise me that there is, that if the law of fraud, the law of negligent misrepresentation, the law of unjust enrichment, the law of negligence as it applies to the data breach claim. I mean, it would surprise me if the elements of those laws varied so considerably from state to state that they presented issues that threatened commonality in a Rule 23 analysis. But again, I would state that I think we can. I think that question would probably benefit most from a class certification brief that directly addressed those issues and analyzed whatever differences there are between the state laws at issue, because I don't know that there are material enough differences to create a manageability issue in this case. The court. And then, finally, what evidence do the plaintiffs anticipate discovery would yield regarding certification of each of the proposed classes? Mr. Beck. Well, I think that discovery in terms of the class certification issues would proceed. I mean, I think it would address each of the Class 23 elements that we'd need to prove to prevail on a motion for class certification. So I think we would be addressing issues of commonality, typicality, predominance, superiority, manageability, all of the standards issues. I think that we would be creating a... Obviously, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the defendants would be conducting discovery of our class representatives. Usually they do something like that from their end. So I think that would be a part of the process. But from our end, we would be taking document discovery that we at this point anticipate would fill in the details of what we've already alleged in the complaint, which is that there was a systematic, unified, and overarching effort to work behind the scenes to advance Hillary Clinton's candidacy to the nomination. And so, from the perspective of commonality, from the perspective of whether any of those common issues predominate in the analysis, which ultimately we would have to show on a Rule 23, those would be the issues that would be addressed in the discovery process. The court. All right, counsel. Thank you very much. I appreciate your answers. Mr. Beck. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. All right. Let me hear from the defense. Mr. Spiva. All righty. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just kind of quickly go through the questions. The court. Take your time. Mr. Spiva. All right. The court. We're not going anywhere. Mr. Spiva. So, I think you already got an answer to the question about whether all the plaintiffs are diverse from each defendant. They are not. And then there are Bernie Sanders donors who would not have standing, was, I think, the first question after that Your Honor asked. And clearly there are. I mean, and clearly the only way to find out would be to do an individualized inquiry of each of them. Because here, where we're talking about reliance, we're talking about knowledge. We're talking about motive. Not only the defendant's alleged motive, but the motive of these individuals. I mean, Bernie Sanders himself endorsed, voted for, campaigned for Hillary Clinton. And so presumably he donated to his own campaign. And I assume he would not consider himself to be a member of this class. And there are other donors. There are millions of Bernie Sanders donors and voters who voted for Hillary Clinton. And so those people would not have standing to bring this suit. They would have no injury. There are many Bernie Sanders donors who gave because they thought the system was rigged, to use Donald Trump's phrase, so that it was an unfair system and they wouldn't have standing. So I think clearly there would. And the greater problem, Your Honor, is that the only way to find out would be to invade, you know, to query each one of them and invade their privacy and First Amendment rights and, on the other hand, invade the privacy, or rather the First Amendment rights of the party. And we heard again and again, the court, just slow down a little bit for the, Mr. Spiva, sure. We heard again and again that certain questions could be potentially resolved through discovery. And one can only imagine how burdensome this discovery would be. Counsel didn't actually specify what types of information that counsel thought he would discover. But clearly there's a contemplation of going through the files of the DNC and trying to explore what the strategy and internal workings of the party was, clearly protected by the First Amendment. And of course we would need to seek discovery of the Sanders campaign and the individuals who gave to Senator Sanders, and individuals who gave to the DNC, and they have a First Amendment right not to be questioned in that way. So to answer Your Honor's second question, a Bernie Sanders supporter who donated to the campaign because of a perceived bias also would not have standing. There was also a phrase that kind of pervaded counsel's last presentation about, it's kind of shifted from the allegations in the complaint, which is that the DNC and Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz deviated from the bylaws in showing impartiality and even-handedness to a focus on the results being predetermined. There's really no allegation in the complaint that the results were predetermined, nor could there be. I mean, millions more people voted for Secretary Clinton than voted for Senator Sanders. And those individuals certainly wouldn't have standing, even though they would fall within one of the subclasses that have been articulated. And one of the answers to that question that Your Honor was given was that it's not plausible that someone would give to the Sanders campaign if they viewed the system as rigged. But I think actually the opposite conclusion is more logical, and certainly apparent, that you would try to beat the system if you viewed it as rigged. Your Honor asked whether there are DNC donors who would not have standing, and clearly there would be. I mean, clearly there are millions of people who voted for Secretary Clinton and gave to the DNC in both the primary and the general, and they would not have standing because they haven't been injured, and they don't agree with the point of view of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. You asked whether a person who gave to the DNC without having read the DNC's charter were any of the allegations where the DNC was alleged to have made statements about neutrality, would that person have standing? Well, there couldn't be reliance if they didn't have any knowledge of the statement, so that person would also not have standing. And then Your Honor asked that if there are members of the plaintiff's proposed classes that would not have standing, how can the court certify the class? And again, the answer was discovery, Your Honor. But I think the answer is actually that really wouldn't be proper to certify a class where certain members of the proposed class don't have standing, and where the only way to determine whether they do is to actually, you know, take discovery from each individual. And that's not going to change. That's the thing. If they're allowed to amend again, that is always going to be the case, that there are going to be some people in these classes, as proposed, who do not have standing. And the only way to determine that is to ask them individually. And that goes to the next question Your Honor asked, which is potentially changing the class definitions. And I think counsel had said that it's not infrequent that class definitions get narrowed or defined. And that is not, It's not that it doesn't ever happen, for sure. But at the same time, it's still the plaintiff's burden to identify an ascertainable class, one that's manageable, that where common issues predominate. And none of that's the case here, Your Honor. And answering Your Honor's next question, it really isn't possible to narrow these class definitions so that the class is ascertainable by objective criteria. All of the allegations in the complaint, and certainly all the statements made today, are shot through with subjective determinations, which can only be resolved through individualized discovery and trial. There was an analogy to securities class actions, which I'd submit, Your Honor, is wildly different from the political realm here with the First Amendment issues that I talked about, where it's potentially the only place where you have a notion of fraud on the market, you know, such that reliance can, in certain circumstances, be presumed totally different and inapplicable, and an inapt analogy to this situation. Your Honor asked whether individual issues would predominate over common issues. I think the answer is clearly yes. I've kind of covered that, so I won't go over that again. Your Honor asked about choice of law, and what law the court would apply to counts 1, 2, 4, and 6. The court. 5. Mr. Spiva. And 5. Thank you. And that's the breach of fiduciary duty count. Yes, I think that's not clear at this point. And I think the answer that I heard, Your Honor, was basically that the plaintiffs sued the defendants, but they're not going to tell the defendants until later what law they've alleged to have violated. Because, of course, if you're not saying what state's fiduciary duty law they've alleged to have violated, or what state's unjust enrichment law, etc., then you're not even meeting the basic requirements under Rule 8. And certainly, class certification is not the stage at which to decide what law applies to the claims that they're asserting. It destroys commonality. It destroys predominance. And I don't think there's a case that I've ever seen, and none has been cited, where a court has said that through the discovery process, a class with 46 states represented could, you know, through the discovery process, we could discover what law applies. That would be totally unimaginable, Your Honor. And I submit it would have to be a violation of due process for the defendant to have to respond to that, and the types of massive discovery that would entail. And it's really their burden to figure this out in advance and put it in their complaint. It's not something to be resolved either through class certification or through discovery. Your Honor asked, assuming that the court must apply the laws of 46 states, would the class action be manageable? And I submit, Your Honor, the question almost answers itself. I mean, you know, no, it would be, I think, an impossible management problem. There'd be no commonality, no predominance. And one of the answers was, it would surprise me if elements of these various causes of action varied so considerably as among states. But again, this is the plaintiff's burden to figure out at the outset. I mean, that's very rare, where a federal court is going to say, well, we're going to apply a nationwide standard of contract, breach of contract, for instance. I'm just using that as an example, because a breach is a breach wherever you are. That's very rare. But certainly, at the very least, the plaintiffs have to identify those causes of action for which the law doesn't vary significantly, and why they could meet the class certification standards, and why it would be manageable. It's not for the court to assume, or for the plaintiffs to assume, and we get to it later. That's just not proper. Your Honor asked, what evidence did the plaintiffs anticipate discovery would yield regarding certification of each of the proposed classes? And I didn't really hear a definite answer other than anything going to the various Rule 23 elements, document discovery, which would fill in the details. And again, the only kind of document discovery that could even conceivably be relevant to the types of claims being made here would totally invade the province of the party's strategizing, their internal workings, and similarly, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz's First Amendment rights as well. And I think frankly, Your Honor, even if that weren't an issue, there really isn't discovery that can fix these problems other than individualized discovery of every single plaintiff. And so, I don't think that that's an adequate answer to Your Honor's question. I don't think there's discovery that can fix the problems with the complaint. The court. All right, thank you. Hold on for one second. Mr. Spiva. Thank you. Discussion had off the record between the court and court reporter. The court. I'm going to give the defense 5 minutes for any additional comments, any clarification of any previous answer or response, and then I'll give 5 minutes to the plaintiff for the same. Mr. Spiva. Thank you, Your Honor. I will endeavor, and I will not repeat what I've said. But I think, starting with standing, this is a case where plaintiffs have not met their burden to show causation of harm here. That a particularized injury that is redressable by the court, and that really should end the lawsuit right there. I think their state law claims, I guess I'll group them, the ones that focus on issues such as fiduciary duty and the like, first, all suffer from the same problem, but also are defective on the pleadings and would be totally unmanageable in terms of a class certification. And then I think what I would do, so as not to repeat, because I have made these arguments, but I just want to emphasize that there really is a body of case law here, I think, that supports the notion that this is really not the province of the courts. This is the rough... What we've heard is the kind of thing... You certainly heard on the Republican side, you know. President Trump alleged that the Republican primary was rigged. He ended up getting more votes than the other primary members, and ultimately at least got more electoral college votes, and that's how our system works. And so this is very common to have these kind of intra-party squabbles about doctrine, about policy, about rules, about selection of delegates. And the courts have said from the O'Brien case to the La Follette case, the Berg v. Obama case, which I think is has some very close similarities to this one, in terms of people saying they were duped by certain statements about what the party stood for. The Wims case in this circuit versus the Republican State Executive Committee. All of these cases, I think, come down to the same thing. That really these are matters for the parties. They are private associations. Yes, they play a big role in the election of the President of the United States, but they are still private associations. They still have a right to order their own affairs. If someone's not happy with the party that they've been aligned with, their choice is to start another party, or to give to the other party, or to give to a candidate that they think will shake things up within the party. But giving a donation gives no one the right to succeed, to have their candidate win an election. It doesn't give them the right to tell the party how to conduct its affairs or to, you know, rifle through the strategizing of the party. And I want to be clear, I know I've said this, but because this has become somewhat of a public case, that the defendants absolutely deny that there was any unfairness here or impartiality. But the allegations that have been made are very common in terms of political process, and the courts have been clear that that is a matter for the parties and for private associations, not for the courts. And I think really that runs through, that premise, that precedent, really runs through all of our arguments. And that's the reason why there's no standing here, why there's a failure to state a claim, and so why this case should be dismissed with prejudice. Thank you, Your Honor. The Court. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Beck. Thank you, Your Honor. And I want to thank the Court for hearing us today. Counsel mentioned a concept that's familiar in the context of securities actions, known as fraud on the market. And his suggestion was that this, to paraphrase him, that this case invokes principles that are wildly different to fraud on the market cases that make the analogy inappropriate. Well, I think that it's an extraordinarily appropriate analogy. We're talking about the political market here. This is fraud on the political market. The DNC, by virtue of how the democracy of this country has developed over history, is one of two parties in a two-party democratic system that essentially has custody over the market for how candidates are chosen and elected and nominated and ultimately run in general elections. And the shareholders in this case are not people that have purchased stock or purchased shares in a company, but they've bought into this political process because at bottom they believe in American democracy and that we live in a democratic system. And they bought into the process how? By donating their money to candidates. In this case, they've donated to Bernie Sanders' campaign. But this is how people participate in the political process these days, aside from voting. And they've also registered as Democrats, because that was the party that they chose to align themselves. And in making those decisions and understanding those actions, I submit that they're no different than people that purchase shares of stock, believing that the company is a good investment. I see no reason that somebody would take their hard-earned money and throw it at a candidate in a Democratic primary, knowing full well that the outcome was predetermined. And I know my friend on the other side takes issue with my use of the word predetermined to describe this election, but I think it's entirely inappropriate because it captures the state of where we are as a country today, which is to say that when you have one of the two major political parties working hand in glove with all of the arrayed media outlets that are in the position of disseminating information to the American public, and they are engaged in a concerted effort to advance one candidate at the expense of the other candidates in the field, I submit that that outcome is nothing other than predetermined. And to say anything less is to undersell the power of politics and media in this country. It may be that we've reached a dire state of affairs in this country politically. When I heard counsel state that it would be more likely for somebody to donate to a candidate if they thought the process was rigged, that made me really sad, actually. I mean, I'm somebody that's donated to political campaigns. I know a lot of people who have donated to political campaigns. And when I made those donations, I never suspected or believed that the process was rigged in the way that we allege that this process was rigged in the complaint. If it's the case that an entity, the DNC, its chairperson can rig an election, and there's no remedy at law for people who've made financial contributions on the basis of what they've omitted to tell the public, well, I submit that that's a really dire road for this country to be on. But what gives me hope is that we have an ancient tradition of common law in this country that goes back even well before the founding of this republic and protects against fraud and protects against deceit. And it makes no exception for people who are in the political realm. And it doesn't offer blanket immunity for people to make misrepresentations simply because those representations are made in the context of a political campaign. The court. 1 minute. Mr. Beck. And they've said that. And again, I think all of their arguments as to why, against us having the right to conduct discovery, fall back on this First Amendment argument, which I submit to the court is a fiction. And I just want to close with this. We're not seeking to undo the results of an election. We're not seeking. We're not sitting here saying that Bernie Sanders should be the nominee and there should be a do-over. We're not asking for relief like that. Our relief is confined to remedying the injuries that we've identified in this complaint, which are very concrete and tied to the payment of money and membership in a political party, and are not tied to any of these voter standing type theories, which you see in all the cases, or many of the cases that they've cited, where a person tries to enforce a political promise, or, for instance, I think an example was given of a promise made by President Trump. None of that is remotely at issue here. We're talking specifically about people who bought into the political process by donating money, by registering as Democrats. If there is no possibility of judicial or legal relief for those individuals, then I submit that the prospects for democracy in this country are dark indeed. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. All right, thank you very much. Well, I want to thank counsel for your responses to the court's questions. They've been very helpful. This is a very interesting case, to say the least. And counsel for the plaintiffs spoke about whether or not our society, these are the court's words, not his words. He did not use the word society. But whether society is in a dire situation. And so I leave the lawyers with this. Democracy demands the truth so people can make intelligent decisions. Everyone have a safe trip back, and I'll be putting together an order based on the arguments presented here today. I'll be candid with you. That's going to take some time. The legal issues are complex for the court to consider and to rule upon. So everyone have a safe trip back, and everyone have a great week. There being no further business, this session of the court is adjourned. Mr. Spiva. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. Take care. Mr. Beck. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Judge. The court. Go ahead. Court's in recess. The judge exited the courtroom. Proceedings concluded at 5:20 p.m. Certificate. I certify that the foregoing is a correct transcript from the record of proceedings in the above-entitled matter. Signed, Francine C. Salopek. Francine C. Salopek, RMR, CRR, Official Court Reporter. 4-28-17. Appendix 2. United States District Court, Southern District of Florida. Case number 1661511, C.V. Zlock. Carol Wilding et al. Plaintiffs. Versus DNC Services Corporation, DBA, Democratic National Committee, et al. Defendants. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, August 23, 2016. Motion hearing before the Honorable William J. Zlock, United States District Judge. Appearances for the plaintiffs. Cullen A. O'Brien, Esquire. Cullen O'Brien Law, P.A. 6541 Northeast 21st Way, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33308. Antonio G. Hernandez, Esquire. Law Office of Antonio G. Hernandez. 4 Southeast 1st Street, 2nd Floor. Miami, Florida, 33131. Elizabeth L. Beck, Esquire. Jared H. Beck, Esquire. Beck and Lee Trial Lawyers. 12485 Southwest 137th Avenue, Suite 205, Miami, Florida, 33186. For the defendants. Bruce B. Spiva, Esquire. Perkins Coie, LLP. 713th Street Northwest, Suite 600, Washington, D.C., 20005. Greg D. Thomas, Esquire. Thomas and LoCicero, P.L. 601 South Boulevard, Tampa, Florida, 33606. Reported by Tammy Nestor, RMR, CRR, Official Court Reporter, 299 East Broward Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33301. Tammy underscore Nestor at flsd.uscourts.gov. Index. Witness. Ricardo Villalba Cabral. Directory cross by Mr. O'Brien, 22 times. Redirect, 30 times. Cross by Mr. Spiva, 25 times. Plaintiff's exhibits. 1, page 6. 2, page 7. 3, page 7. 5, page 43. Defendant's exhibits. 1 and 2, page 40. Thereupon, the following proceedings began at 10:59 a.m. The court. Good morning. Please be seated. Calling case number 1661511, civil. Counsel, would you note your appearances? Mr. O'Brien. Good morning, Your Honor. Cullen O'Brien for the plaintiffs. Mr. Hernandez. Antonio Hernandez for the plaintiff's judge. Ms. Beck. Elizabeth Beck for the plaintiffs. Mr. Beck. Jared Beck for the plaintiffs. The court. Good morning. Mr. Spiva. Good morning, Your Honor. Bruce Spiva from Perkins Coie for the DNC and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The court. Good morning. Mr. Thomas. Greg Thomas, on behalf of both the defendants. The court. Good morning. Please be seated. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. We are here this morning pursuant to the defendant's motion, which the court, the defendant's motion to dismiss, which the court has considered a motion to quash service of process. The court has set an evidentiary hearing on the motion to quash. Is the plaintiff ready? Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for being late. We were outside getting some stipulations to try to move this thing along. The court. That is fine. Mr. O'Brien. May I present some of the stipulations to Your Honor? The court. Sure, go right ahead. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. So, we plan to show Your Honor a video of the service of process event. The defendants stipulate to it coming in, admissibility, except there are some statements that are made by the people on the video that the defendants want not considered by this court. We would have no objection to that. The court, that is fine. Mr. O'Brien. And then we have a witness. I'm sorry. The court, just a moment. Has the video been marked as a plaintiff's exhibit? Is it a CD or DVD? Mr. O'Brien. It's on a jump drive. The court. Okay. And that is going to have to be marked as plaintiff's number one. Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. Plaintiff's one. The court. Any objection? Mr. Spiva. No objection, Your Honor. Assuming this is the YouTube video. Because there are some other video exhibits that I understand the plaintiffs are intending to... Mr. O'Brien. I think you mean Facebook. I think you may have it reversed. Mr. Spiva. I thought you were talking about the YouTube. Assuming we are talking about the Facebook live stream, we don't have objection to that, with the exception of the court, the statements. Mr. Spiva, there's some verbiage about the DNC has accepted service. That is our objection to that. The court. You can point that out to the court during the video. Mr. Spiva, will do, Your Honor. The court. That's fine. Plaintiff's one being a thumb drive is in evidence. Thereupon, plaintiff's one received in evidence. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The second stipulation, Your Honor, would be a police report regarding the death of the process server, as well as an email confirming same to plaintiff's counsel. The defendants do not object to that coming into evidence. The court. All right. And what exhibit number is that? Mr. O'Brien. May we make that, Your Honor, exhibits 2 and 3? Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. For the record, plaintiff's 2 is... Mr. O'Brien. The police report that was attached to our response. I don't want to mischaracterize it, but we would say it's a police report of the death of the process server. The court. All right. That is plaintiff's 2. Is there any objection? Mr. Spiva. No objection, Your Honor. My understanding is it's being offered to show his availability. The court. Plaintiff's 2 is in evidence. Thereupon, plaintiff's 2 received in evidence. The court. And plaintiff's 3. Mr. O'Brien. Your Honor, it would be an email from the D.C. police attaching the police report to plaintiff's counsel, confirming that the death report is a person by the name of Sean Lucas. The court. Any objection? Mr. Spiva. No objection, Your Honor. The court. Plaintiff's 3 is in evidence. Thereupon, plaintiff's 3 received in evidence. Mr. O'Brien. With respect to what is going... What we ask Your Honor to consider on the video, the defendants have stipulated that the woman towards the end of the video is Ms. Rebecca Harries, and that they have also stipulated that the gentleman who is bald is the Sean Lucas that is in the police report. The court. Okay. Mr. O'Brien. So that takes care of a bunch of exhibits. The court. Fine. Mr. O'Brien. And then we do have a dispute, Your Honor. On the last exhibit. It would be an email that was obtained on WikiLeaks. I believe the defendant... I'll let the defendant state their position. But the nature of the dispute as I understand it. The defendants... The court. Would you be offering this email? Mr. O'Brien. I want to offer it. And I don't just want to offer it just to show that Rebecca Harries was the special assistant to the then CEO... The purpose that I want to offer it for is that we believe the email speaks for itself. It shows Ms. Harries organizing a staff-wide meeting. And our argument would be, based on that, that Ms. Harries is someone who would have that sort of authority to accept service. That would be the purpose for which we would want to issue the... have the email into evidence. But there is a dispute. They object to it coming into evidence. They would stipulate that Ms. Harries is the special assistant, was the special assistant to the then CEO of the DNC. But beyond that, the court. Just slow down a little bit. Take a deep breath. Mr. O'Brien. Sorry, Your Honor. Too much coffee. The court. That's all right. Slow down for the court reporter. Finish your statement, though. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The defendants would at least stipulate that Ms. Harries, at the time of the disputed service of process event, was the special assistant to the then CEO. But beyond that, they object to anything else. So we may ask Your Honor to rule in advance about the email or however Your Honor wants to handle that. The court. All right. Do you want to have that marked as an exhibit? You would intend to offer it if allowed? Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. The court. And that would be plaintiffs 4? Mr. O'Brien. 4, Your Honor. The court. And this is an email from... Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Harries. The court. 2. Mr. O'Brien. Staff at the DNC. The court. First of all, let me see the email. Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. May I approach? The court. Yes. Mr. O'Brien. Okay, this is... The court. Show it to counsel. Mr. O'Brien. Is this okay? Mr. Spiva. It's the one that you gave us. Yes. Mr. O'Brien. Okay, thank you. Your Honor, the demarcation is when we had submitted our exhibit list, it was a different exhibit. The court. That's all right. First of all, you will need to remark this. Do you have stickers? Mr. O'Brien. We do, Your Honor. We have a clean copy. The court. What would be the objection? Mr. Spiva. Well, Your Honor, there are at least two that I just note. First of all, that we would stipulate that she was the special assistant to the then CEO, and that's the only real purpose that I think this email could serve. Our objections are as follows. One, this email was stolen, and there is case law that even if, you know, counsel, obviously we are not suggesting that they stole the email, but WikiLeaks obtained it from a stolen source, that it is still a confidential email and it shouldn't be permitted to be used. There is an ACLU case out of the District of Columbia that holds that, and the court. Do you have that cite? Mr. Spiva. Yes, Your Honor. Can I get it to you in just a minute? I think I might need to consult an electronic device, Your Honor. I apologize. A second basis, Your Honor. There is really no way to authenticate this, I don't think, with any of the people that are on their witness list. And also it's hearsay. So we would have those objections as well. Mainly, I don't see why they need it. We are willing to stipulate that that was in fact her title, Special Assistant to Ms. Dacey. The court. Any reply to those objections? Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. I will start with the caveat that I have not seen the DC case or in Westlaw. I searched WikiLeaks and I couldn't find a case on this. So I don't know. I think this may be a first impression as to whether something like this could come in based on the allegation that it's stolen, although we don't have proof it's stolen. But we wanted Ms. Harries here. The court. I understand. Mr. O'Brien. We asked them to bring Ms. Harries here so we can cross-examine her or take her testimony. We don't have her. The court. But they were not required to do that. Mr. O'Brien. They were not required, and she's outside the subpoena power. We wanted to establish, because it's our burden, that Ms. Harries had the authority. This email not only shows that she was the special assistant, which they stipulated in their motion to quash, but she's organizing the court. Well, they stipulated to it here today. Mr. O'Brien. Here today? Yes, Your Honor. They stipulated to it here today. In this email, we would be offering it not just for that purpose, but because it appears that she's organizing a DNC-wide meeting in the Wasserman conference room. So our argument would be, based on that, that she is the kind of person, If she's organizing a meeting for the entire DNC in the Wasserman conference room, then she's someone with authority to come down and get service on Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC. That would be the argument we would make. As far as hearsay, I think it would be non-hearsay, because it would be an admission. We cited in our exhibit list Rule 801-D2. Alternatively, it's a hearsay exception under Rule 803, subsection 6. I think it's a business record. I think it's self-authenticating. And the only way we could think to try to get it in would be to have our two witnesses say they went to WikiLeaks, which they did, typed in Becca Harry's, which they did, and saw this exhibit on WikiLeaks. I mean, I don't know how else to get it in other than to say that someone went to the Internet, which is what happened. That would be our way to try to get it in. The court. I am going to reserve on plaintiff's four at this point. I'm going to reserve ruling on it. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. Let me just ask for a clarification so that the record is clear. Do you have an extra copy of plaintiff's four? Mr. O'Brien. May I give you a clean copy, Your Honor? The court. You hold on to the clean copy, because this is not marked other than the exhibit number. That is not pertinent right now. So you hold on to the plain copy. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. Just make sure you mark them with the appropriate exhibit sticker. All the exhibits. I have reviewed the complaint and the first amended complaint. Counsel, go ahead and be seated. Mr. Spiva. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. I have received the complaint and the first amended complaint. Is it the plaintiff's position that Congresswoman Schultz is being sued individually and not in her capacity as then the chair of the DNC? Mr. O'Brien. May I consult with my colleagues? I think I need to make sure that I get this answer right, Your Honor. The court. Because if you read the complaint and the first amended complaint, and in particular, page 20 of the first amended complaint. But go ahead, consult with your counsel. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Spiva. Would it be all right if I consult my electronic device to get you that site while they're conferring? The court. Go right ahead. Mr. Spiva. Thank you. Mr. O'Brien. Your Honor, thank you. I think Your Honor is referring to paragraph 154 on page 20. The court. Well, paragraph 154 in particular. Mr. O'Brien. I think we would take the position that our complaint is suing Ms. Wasserman Schultz in her individual capacity. The court. Okay. Mr. O'Brien. She happened to be a chairperson, but this is in her individual capacity, Your Honor. The court. All right. Because obviously, that capacity would affect the service of process analysis. Mr. O'Brien. I think Your Honor could reasonably state that because it's in her individual capacity, maybe we had to treat her, go to her house or something like that. But we would be taking the argument that because she was DNC chair at the time, that that was a good place to serve her. And beyond that, based on what Ms. Harry said, she accepted service on behalf of... The court. No, I understand. We will get to the argument at a later point. But for the purposes of the record, just so the record is clear, Congresswoman Schultz is being sued in her individual capacity. Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor, in the first amended complaint, Your Honor. Mr. Spiva. May I be heard on that briefly, Your Honor? The court. Yes. Mr. Spiva. Our understanding up until now is that she was being sued in her corporate capacity. The court. That is why I asked for the clarification. Mr. Spiva. So this is kind of the first time we are learning this as well. So I just wanted to make that point. The court. Counsel, go ahead. Mr. O'Brien. With the argument. The court. Are we finished with exhibits? Mr. O'Brien. We are finished with exhibits, Your Honor. May I discuss the witnesses? The court. Go right ahead. Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Spiva.
Your Honor, sorry to interrupt. I did find the site that I was looking for. One of the reasons we didn't have this in our reply brief is we didn't know this was going to be one of their exhibits until after we had filed it.
The court. That's fine.
Mr. Spiva. But the case that I was citing was ACLU versus Department of State, 879 F. Supp, 2nd 215. And that's out of the DDC 2012. And that's one of the cases that suggests that...
The court. That is out of the D.C. Circuit.
Mr. Spiva. Yes, well, it's the district court in D.C., yeah.
The court. District court case. Mr. Spiva.
Correct, Your Honor.
The court. Okay. Mr. Spiva.
And the case where the ACLU sought to obtain some documents that had been published on WikiLeaks that the government contended had been stolen or leaked. And the court said, you know, that you couldn't... that the ACLU couldn't obtain those documents or use those documents despite that they were public.
The court. I will take a look at that. Thank you.
Mr. O'Brien. Your Honor, may we on our side be able to respond to this case?
The court. Sure.
Mr. O'Brien. I don't want to give Your Honor an impression that we are trying to make Your Honor rule inconsistent with the case, but I want to see this case and...
The court. That's fine.
Mr. O'Brien. Thank you.
The court. All right. Are you ready to proceed with the evidentiary phase of the trial?
Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor. One stipulation on witnesses and then one manner of disagreement on witnesses.
The court. Go right ahead.
Mr. O'Brien. Our first witness we would like to call is Ricardo Villalba, and he was the videographer. I don't believe there is any objection to him testifying by the defendants.
The court. Any objection?
Mr. Spiva.
No blanket objection to his testifying, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, we would have to see what he says. But yes, we don't have an objection. A blanket objection.
The court.
Let me just ask you this for a convenience of time standpoint. If there is no objection to the video, do you think you still need the witness?
Mr. O'Brien. We wanted to be very careful, because it's our burden. We wanted as many witnesses as we could possibly have. We wanted the security guards. We wanted Ms. Harries. We brought him in the abundance of caution. I do agree with Your Honor that much of what the witness will say will be apparent on the video. But in case Your Honor had any questions, or in case there's just context we wanted to give Your Honor for why he was there, but, yeah... Since the video is now in evidence, there is very little that would be helpful. However, in an abundance of caution, he flew down from D.C. for this hearing, so we wanted to make him available and we intended to call him.
The court. If you wish to, go right ahead. Or you can have him... Obviously, he will be here throughout the hearing. If anyone has any questions regarding the video, he could be called to the witness stand. But proceed in whatever fashion you would like to.
Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Your Honor. The second witness would be the first-named plaintiff, Ms. Carol Wilding, who is here. The defendants object to her testifying. We would want her to testify in case it was needed to show that she watched the live stream. The video of service of process event was on live stream on Facebook, and she watched it in case... because it's our burden to give a different perspective of what was happening, and to testify she didn't hear anything inconsistent with what's on the video. This is an abundance of caution. I understand that we don't want to duplicate or take up Your Honor's time unnecessarily, but we wanted to make sure we had as many witnesses as possible here.
The court. The video obviously speaks for itself, correct?
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court.
And what is on the video is on the video.
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court.
And Ms. Wilding would not testify as to anything different, correct?
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court.
So do you think that you still need her as a witness?
Mr. O'Brien.
No, Your Honor.
Now that there is a stipulation of the video into evidence, the other thing would be to bring in that WikiLeaks either through the first witness or the second witness. We were prepared to have them say, because it's true, They went to WikiLeaks, and that's how we would get the exhibit in.
The court. Regarding plaintiffs four.
Mr. O'Brien. Correct, Your Honor.
The court. The email.
Mr. O'Brien. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Spiva. Your Honor, we don't think she's a competent witness to testify to either of those things. I mean, she didn't take the video. At least Mr. And I don't want to butcher his name. Mr. Villalba?
Mr. O'Brien. Villalba.
Mr. Spiva.
Villalba, thank you. You know, he apparently took the video, and I assume was going to testify to that. But she didn't take the video. They are just saying she watched it, which means that if she's a competent witness to testify to what's in the video, anyone in America, really, who saw the video would be a competent witness. So we would object to that, Your Honor. And as far as the WikiLeaks document, again, she didn't create the document. She didn't receive the document. She's just saying she pulled it up on WikiLeaks. And so we don't think she's competent to testify to that, either.
The court. Well, if you want to call the witness with respect to whatever she did at WikiLeaks, feel free to do that. You can call that witness whenever you wish to. If you want to go forward with the video first, that is up to you.
Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would like to go forward with the video first.
And my colleague, Ms. Beck, is going to play the video if Your Honor would allow it.
The court.
Fine.
Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court. This is Plaintiffs 1. Take your time. If you need assistance, we have our technical assistant here.
Thereupon, the videotape was played.
Mr. O'Brien.
Your Honor, for the record, that was Plaintiff's Exhibit 1. And now Ms. Beck will be playing Plaintiff's Exhibit 2, if Your Honor would allow it.
The court. Which is a continuation of the video?
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, Your Honor, there is a couple-minute gap in it.
The court. All right, but we are still on Plaintiff's 1, for the record.
Mr. O'Brien.
It's a composite one. I apologize, Your Honor.
The court. That's all right, because Plaintiff's 2 is a police report.
Mr. O'Brien, I apologize, Your Honor.
The court. That's all right, don't worry about it.
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thereupon, the videotape was played.
Mr. O'Brien.
Your Honor, that completes Exhibit 1. And we have offered that into evidence. I would like to offer into evidence as well Plaintiff's Exhibits 2 and 3.
The court. All right. Now, already in evidence is Plaintiff's 1, composite 1, being the thumb drive. Plaintiff's 2 and Plaintiff's 3 are in evidence. The court has reserved on Plaintiff's 4.
Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to call Mr. Villalba. Ricardo Villalba.
The court. Fine. Please step up to the witness stand.
The witness.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Or good afternoon.
The court. Please remain standing and raise your right hand.
Ricardo Villalba Cabral, having been first duly sworn on oath, was examined and testified as follows.
The court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
You can adjust that microphone. Please speak directly into it.
Please state your full legal name for the record and spell your last name for the reporter.
The witness.
My first name is Ricardo. R-I-C-A-R-D-O.
Do I have to give my middle name too, or...
The court. No, just your last name.
The witness.
My last name. I have two last names. Villalba Cabral. The first last name is spelled V-I-L-L-A-L-B-A. And my second last name is C-A-B-R-A-L.
The court. Thank you. You may proceed.
Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Direct examination by Mr. O'Brien.
Question.
Good morning, sir.
Answer.
Good morning.
Question.
Sir, where do you live?
Answer.
I live in Washington, D.C.
Question.
How long have you lived there?
Answer.
For about 20-plus years.
Question.
What is your profession?
Answer. I am a substance abuse case manager for youth. I am also a filmmaker, you know.
Question.
You saw the video that was played here in court, sir?